So thank you very much to all our speakers. Now we will start the question and answer period from the audience. There are microphones located on both aisles here. So if you have any specific questions for our panel, please feel free to come up to the microphone. I'll have to start the panel, perhaps start with Professor Kirshen. Do you have any reactions to what you've heard so far tonight?
I want to ask a question to Christopher. You talked about carbon taxes. Could you compare carbon taxes with cap and trade, which is the other mechanism that has been proposed for reducing emissions?
Yes. I could compare them. Would you like me to? So I'll be brief. A carbon tax and a cap and trade system are alternative ways of attaching a price to carbon emissions. And in principle, in a textbook world, they're actually pretty close to equivalent, or at least under some conditions. Okay? Two differences. Number one, let me just assume that enforcement, design is sensible and enforcement is appropriate. A carbon tax will guarantee the price that everybody pays for emissions. If you have a path of a carbon tax moving forward, then the price you pay for emissions is determined by that path. If you have a cap and trade system, what you're setting is not the price, but you're setting the quantity, the amount of pollution, the amount of carbon emissions permitted in any given year. And the price that firms end up paying for the tradable permits ends up being determined in a free market. And so in the cap and trade system, what we're certain about is the amount that pollution will fall. Under the carbon tax system, what we're certain about is the price that everybody will pay. Okay? So they're kind of opposite. We're certain about different things. That's one important difference. The second difference is that a tax is administratively far simpler. And a cap and trade system, because we create these things that are tradable pollution permits that are effectively securities, has to get into securities regulation and lawyers that go with securities regulation and corruption that goes with lawyers and securities regulation. And so administratively, I think cap and trade systems are just more complicated.
No more questions. Sir, please.
Yeah, I have two questions for Mr. Edo from the Golden State. My first question is the energy storage mandate by the state of California. You mentioned calls for 1.3 gigawatt of energy storage by the year 2020. Normally we use megawatt for power capacity, and energy storage we typically talk in terms of megawatt hours or gigawatt hours. So my question is, why do they use the unit gigawatt for their target for energy storage?
I don't have a good answer for you, but I can tell you that they considered, in looking at the different use cases, what the amount of watt hours that would need to be associated with the watts of capacity for those different applications. But again, I think the legislation was written in terms of, and the way it was framed was written in terms of an installed capacity target.
My second question was the chart you showed with regards to targets for transmission, distribution, and customers. The public transit agencies that operate rail transportation networks in California, such as BART in San Francisco or LA Metro as an example, would they fall into the customers category for the
targets? That would be my understanding, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
And I have a question now for Professor Bernier regarding the potential. Please. The audience first. We've talked enough.
All right. Very interesting conversations and very interesting presentations as well. I'm going to ask you something that is related, but a bit different. I spent quite a bit of time talking to various policymakers from Canada and England about the potential economic repercussions, but also physical repercussions on the system itself of a potential CME. Now, coronal mass ejections are rare events. However, they have roughly a 100-year cycle, and we're about at the peak of the next event, according to various individuals. Now, estimates range between, if one were to hit North America or Europe, you could have blackouts that would last between a few weeks to a few months. Now, what I'm curious about is if we were to improve some of these energy storage facilities or capabilities, could we somehow mitigate some of those negative impacts on the grid itself?
I have a perspective. I think it depends on where the storage is located. My understanding is that the vulnerability of the power system has to do with the damage to transformers that would be initiated by the electromagnetism. And so if the storage is located downstream of the transformers, and again, this speaks to Professor Yost's discussion about microgrids, then you would have a more distributed form of supply that would be more resilient to attack on or, you know, threats to the bulk power distribution system, because I think the biggest concern is irreparable damage to very large transformers. The other professors, I'm sure, have other perspectives too.
Well, if you had a highly distributed power system where a lot of the energy is generated very locally, and you had local storage, yes, then it would improve the resilience. If we're not there, meaning, you know, there's a bit of storage in your garage and mine, well, you might have another 2-3 hours of electricity, but then you'd still be in the dark for a few months. So I don't see it as the best way of improving resilience of the grid to those events.
Thank you.
What it brings up is also the conversation we've had in the past. What if, you know, in Europe now, fast forward 20, 30 years from now, what if there is a low-pressure system that just stalls over Europe and nothing, no wind blows for, I don't know, 2 weeks? What happens? That's another question. Do we have enough storage to deal with that? Sir.
My questions possibly will apply mostly to Canada, and many of our experts come from elsewhere. There are two unspoken assumptions that I am not hearing spoken about, and maybe because I'd worked in BC where wilderness is everywhere, they arise to my head. And I also listen to Vermont News, and they're a tiny little market with giant grids crossing them. Implicit in a lot of your storage technologies is that they are direct current sources of power. And so you either have to do relatively inefficient conversions from AC to DC and then from DC storage to AC again and try to synchronize frequencies and make sure all of those stability questions of the AC grid are sustained, or you're going to have to slowly but steadily convert the North American grid to a DC grid. And that's particularly important on the local distribution questions I heard addressed. I can't imagine converting those little micro and nano grids to be synchronous with the AC system. Have you exactly looked at how much capital is involved in converting the entire grid from AC and substations and power generation and controls to DC? And the second one I want to just throw in is, especially when we're talking distributed power like these wind sources, which are dominant in Quebec, in BC they inevitably generate vast human intrusions into vast territories which are now wilderness. Essentially, we're not internalizing the costs of converting wilderness to settled, civilized land. And in BC, that's costly. It has tremendous effects on water courses. It has tremendous effects on wildlife populations. All the services that the environment gives us are affected when we turn lots of little transmission lines and pathways into power stations and control units all over the place. Why aren't we internalizing wilderness when we're talking about this? So the two questions are capitalizing the change from AC to DC, and how much external values have we taken into account? I hope this is not too abstract. They jump to my mind whenever we talk like this.
Okay, so you want to jump in about the DC?
No.
This is a can of worms.
No, it's the cost.
It's the cost.
Yeah, the DC technologies, in my perspective, have values at the two extremes of the grid. One, DC is more efficient and more stable when you're talking about transmitting large amounts of power over long distances. And we're already doing quite a bit of that, and that amount is growing. At the other end, within your house, it does make sense to have a bit of a DC grid because you are using a lot of things. You know, your computers are running on DC, your television is running on DC, and so if we could have just one DC converter rather than going back and forth between AC and DC, that could save a lot of money. In between, I'm not convinced that DC makes sense. I don't have any numbers to back that up, but that's my feeling at this point.
And I guess in terms of the land use, Joe, if you want to perhaps comment. Well, again, it's one of those externalities that need to be quantified in some way or another in the planning process.
I also want to comment on the DC.
Okay.
Now, DC is making inroads in places where it makes economic sense right now, and those are like data centers, you know, where they can drive the large racks without having to convert the electricity. But to your earlier comment, the inverters are quite efficient, and they're also quite controllable. So I don't think that's a barrier to more DC power. But the main observation that Jay's has sort of said under his breath is, you know, the AC system is working. And so, you know, this is a system that changes very slowly. So, you know, you see niche applications of DC like these data centers. You see niche high voltage applications where there's power that's very distant from its point of use, and it makes sense to just build a pipe straight from one point to the other. But in between, you know, we have a large AC network, and you know, much as we want to modernize the grid, the basic infrastructure that is here standing today will still be standing here 10 years from now and 20 years from now, and we need to figure out how to operate it better, not think that we're going to replace it wholesale. To the other question, and perhaps Professor Ragan will also comment, is that, you know, the world, there's not a free lunch out here. You know, the whole point of a carbon tax is to try to internalize the cost that's associated with the damage that we believe carbon is causing to our planet and to make it evident in the decisions that people make. But that said, the decisions that we make, they're all having costs. And, you know, I think there's been a big challenge to the wind farm development because it takes up an enormous amount of land. And that's just a fact. Jeff showed a picture of those farms in Germany. I've been in parts of the Pacific Northwest where it's just a blanket of these things. And, you know, if you like technology, it's great. But, you know, if you were used to seeing open fields, you know, it's quite a difference. And I guess the question is, well, how do we as a society want to make the trade-off between the choices we have for how we use energy and how we produce energy? And that's really what these discussions are about, I say, at bottom.
I couldn't add anything to that. That was perfect, everything he said.
Sir.
Yeah, that the last question, it kind of reminds me, it doesn't remind me when I was alive, Tesla talking to Edison saying, hey, Tesla's in Europe, he wants AC, he's got AC, and the United States wanted DC. And, you know, Edison supposedly paid Tesla $50,000 to get the technology. He still hasn't paid him. Maybe that's why the discussion is going 150 years later. That's just a moot point. That's my view. I'm a civil engineer. Okay, now look, I thought we solved this problem 50 years ago. I mean, I worked on the nuclear power plant in Rajasthan, India, in the 1960s. It was the first nuclear power plant in India. And I remember it cost, I'm talking about costs now. It cost $1 million a megawatt. And it was very simple, a lot of concrete, and, you know, all the nuclear technology was CANDU. And CANDU's still around, a little modified now, but still. And I went to the conference board. I was invited there to have a discussion on nuclear. Now, I know you're not talking about nuclear, but I just want to get you a cost a story out there that is probably similar to what you guys are talking about. And all of a sudden, we come to the conference board. That was a couple of years ago, 50 years later. And they're saying, now it's going to cost $6 million a megawatt. And I says, is that the price of concrete that's gone up or what? I mean, you know, there's a problem with costing these things. And there's no competition to identify any new technology. The sky's the limit. And the politicians are obviously going to say, hey, we can't afford this. And that's, I'm sure they're saying that with a carbon tax and whatever you want. So I'd like to know what controls, what regulation do we require to identify that, hey, there's the sky's not the limit. Maybe the technology and the, you know, is a limit, but is, you know, we can great think we're great engineers, eh? We're not paid like doctors and lawyers, that's for sure. And by the way, this whole problem is waiting for the lawyers to line themselves up. This is a global thing. The lawyers got to be all lined up globally, and they'll say, well, now we can each make a buck. And I heard this story 10, 15 years ago, and they're still lining themselves up.
Sir,
so my question is,
yes,
how do you control the costs?
So the question was, how much could storage cost? So I don't know.
That one's yours.
Christopher.
I have a simple and fully unsatisfactory answer to how do you control costs on government procurement, which is competition. It's the only thing that I think ever works, ever has, probably ever will. So if you don't have, which means, we in this country, it means governments should be able to get proposals from outside the province. And it means the federal government needs proposals from outside the country. This actually runs rather in opposition to most human nature, which is very protectionist. So if we really want to lower the costs of building, it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's a nuclear plant or a hospital or a road. It doesn't have to be high tech to have this problem. Is we need genuine competition in the procurement process.
And I think we
don't hold your breath. Because that means you need politicians, and you know you need to force politicians to open up to competition. And that means you have to really believe it. And 30 million other people have to really believe it.
When we were negotiating a contract with India, I remember it well. We weren't talking to India. India wasn't talking to us. That was 1960. And we had an intermediary who, we had to have an agent to put the deal together. And the project cost $200 million for 15%. Hey, that was part of the cost because we don't even talk to each other. In that case, it was $15 million to some stranger in the Middle East.
Okay. And, sir?
Yeah, my question is for Jeff Gostick.
That's a humorous anecdote.
Oh, sorry.
Oh. The reason why pumped hydro was developed in my country was a direct offspring of the nuclear power plant development program, because these units, to be economic, had to be of such a large size that the utilities didn't know what they were going to do with the power at night when people went to sleep. And so that was the whole reason why our pumped storage industry was developed.
Funny.
Just to bring it back to another reason why storage, you know, has these important values.
Well, it's just like the lights on the highways in France. There's so much lighting in the...
And I can add another one about the cost of storage. You know, there's something called community energy storage, where you can go and buy batteries that might, you know, help a few houses and things like that. Well, it turns out that that's about the same size batteries as you get in a small electric car. Now, if you ask a quote for community energy storage batteries, well, that's about the cost of an electric car. So you're getting the car for free with the batteries, and you can choose the color of the car, obviously. So it shows that there is still quite a bit of an inefficiency in the cost of battery energy storage for grid applications compared to what car manufacturers have been able to do.
Sir, please.
So actually my question is with regards to battery efficiency. You spoke of flow batteries. It was somewhat the first time that I hear about this. One of the ratings that we use in battery technology is the C rating. And, you know, the higher that the C rating is, the better the battery can deliver energy and recoup that energy or recharge itself. Recently I've been reading that lithium titanate can reach a level of C15. in your vision, these flow batteries, what kind of C rating can we reach if that seems to be the next big thing in battery technology?
Well, I mean, C rating is sort of, you know, got a bunch of things included. I think to break it down more simply, the faster you discharge the battery, the less efficient it is because you bring in heat generation and all kinds of side reactions and so on. So if you charge and discharge your thing very, very slowly, you have very high efficiency. So that's the what you're looking for in an electrical storage system. So that the battery will be designed that way to operate it fairly. You have a large battery with low current density instead of a small battery with very high current density. So because you have the luxury of having lots of space and presumably at your generation and storage site, you can operate your battery efficiently.
So what footprint can this type of battery take in with regards to the same capacity as a lithium battery, for example?
The power generation device, the cell itself can be made small if you engineer it to, you know, have lots of surface area and so on, so that it has, you know, good power performance characteristics. You're limited really by the size of the tanks storing the fuel. So, and the fuel is a dissolved electrolyte, which has a solubility limit. You know, you put too much salt in your water, and it's, you know, no longer get dissolving, you get crystals. So the you can play games with increasing the solubility of your fuels, choosing different fuels that have different solubilities. So you get to be quite variable the size of the tank that you'll need, and you know, those are all things that people are aiming for to improve. But as far as actual footprints, I wouldn't want to hazard a guess right now off the top of my head. Sorry.
Okay. Give you an idea. A one megawatt battery is about the size of a large shipping container, and typically they are sold as a shipping container containing everything.
For both about the same size,
lithium ion and flow batteries.
Okay, we'll take one last question before we wrap it up.
Well, three last questions, please. They're quick. I mean, it depends on you. First of all, about the flow battery. Are these chemicals repleatable? I mean, is this a two-way process like lithium batteries?
Absolutely, yeah. They're extremely durable in the sense that there's no phase change going on. You don't have something dissolving and replating. You don't have lithium moving in and out of a structure. You have a liquid dissolved ion that just comes in contact with a solid and changes its oxidation state and then goes away. So in that respect, they're extremely appealing.
And that's true with the full list?
I actually avoid. There are some. I know the soluble lead battery I threw on there because I wanted to point out lead. It has a phase change going on, and there's a zinc polysulfide battery that has a phase change, where you're plating out metal and unplating the metal. Mm-hmm. Not in a fancy structure like a lead battery a zinc battery. You're just plating it as a thick solid layer, so you don't have to worry about structure and things. There are some technologies that are a little more complicated, but all the ones I showed were simply liquid phase reactions, I believe.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Second question is, you have shown many means of storage, but are these only the most viable, the most feasible, or are they all we can do?
Was that for me or for everybody?
It was for everybody.
Okay. Viable, of course, is the first thing you have to think about as an engineer. So the ones I showed tonight are viable. You can imagine other things, I suppose.
On large scale, you mean,
sure.
Right?
Sure. Yeah.
One technology that was not discussed explicitly tonight was mechanical storage in the form of flywheels, of which there are a number of companies trying to develop that for very short duration, high power applications.
Hmm. Okay, thank you. And my last question was about the graph. I believe Mr. Bernier showed on the ground storage, the ground heat storage. It showed some irregularities by the end on the two last cycles. Is this something you've noticed? Is this something that is it a tendency that will continue and snowball?
I think you're referring to the last two cycles where the curve showed
dips in the dips and valleys and whatnot. I believe that's due to the fact that there was some variability in with the solar injection and or the space heating needs, great variations, okay? So when you have that, this curve goes up and down quite frequently.
Okay, but the ground and ecosystem can deal with this?
Yes. Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
So it's about time, I think, we start to wrap up. So thank you very much to the audience for coming. Thank you for staying with us. Thank you to our speakers, especially Joe Etto and Daniel Kirshen, who made it from far away to attend this event. I'd also like to thank the TISED staff, Lauren Penny, Robin Devine, Professor Gauchal, the director of TISED, for support for this event. This wouldn't have happened but without them. And also, finally, Dr. Lauren Trottier and his generous support to the Trottier Family Foundation. So thank you for coming. We hope you've learned something. Hopefully that you think that perhaps storage is part of the solution and that perhaps carbon taxes might be also part of the solution. And we hope to see you at the TISED event or sustainability event later. Thank you very much.